a supplementary oral history interview with Professor Emeritus Henry Hart, conducted at his home on 17th of December 2002. This supplements an oral history conducted by Laura Smale in 1982, and we'll cover aspects that were not featured in that earlier oral history. Henry, the previous oral history covered well your early years, your undergraduate years at Vanderbilt, your connections with the Tennessee Valley Authority, and so forth. So let's cut in to the story at the time of your, presumably when you completed your military service during World War II, and were looking for an opportunity for graduate student study. How did you decide to pursue a PhD in political science and to choose UW-Madison as the place to do it?
To tell you the truth, Crawford, I had not been thinking during the considerable time I had in the Army to ponder my post-war course. I had not been thinking of political science. I had been thinking of economics with an emphasis on labor relations. My undergrad major was psychology. I had worked in the Tennessee Valley Authority in the department, the personnel department, trying to use that psychology. And I knew that I didn't want to be a personnel man, but I thought that by training myself in labor economics, I could get out into larger issues, still saving that base in the psychology of human capacities and relations. And I went so far as to interview at the University of Chicago, I've forgotten exactly what year that was, but it was not at the end of my military service. It was during some interval, I think. In any event, I got around all of the big guns in the economics department until I got to Millis, and then he asked me, well, I assume you want to go for a PhD. And I said, no, as a matter of fact, I want to take a list of courses that interest me. I have no need for a degree. And he said, why did you say that? We can't give you any support just for taking a miscellaneous list of courses. So that set me back in that pursuit. And I had some more time to ponder, and I realized that the main non-academic knowledge that I had, which went beyond my psychology undergrad major, was in the program of the TVA itself. And therefore, I decided to go to a place where I could best get an academic appraisal, an academic understanding of the Tennessee Valley Authority. With that question, there was absolutely no doubt about where I should go. I should go study with John Goss, because he was the accomplished political scientist who, by his service during the Roosevelt period, had made a real study of regional planning, and even considered the question of whether river basins would constitute a viable criterion for defining internal regions within the United States. That was published as one of the documents of the Roosevelt Regional Planning Initiatives. He had also, of course, written that monumental story of the United States Department of Agriculture, which had within it, many of the Roosevelt programs, the Soil Conservation Service, the complete transformation of the Forest Service, and other things that bore on my own existing interests. So I made up my mind to go to the University of Wisconsin with that in view. When I arrived, my aside from the GI Bill, my money support was by being a grad teaching assistant, and I was extraordinarily embarrassed to have to report to the political science department that up to that point I'd had one course in political science, and that was a course taught by D.F. Fleming on the origins of World War I, which consisted mainly of a textual analysis of all of the cablegrams exchanged between the great powers who entered that conflict up to the time of the outbreak of war. So I was unqualified to teach American government, and I was particularly embarrassed because when I looked over the roster and asked some of my new acquaintances in the department who these people were, one of the enrollees in the course where I was to be a TA was a young fellow who was the campaign manager of one of the candidates for governor in the fall election, and I knew if that fellow spoke up in class, I would be absolutely unable to answer any of his questions about the working of the practical working of the American political system. But I need not have worried, because he was involved in the campaign and he never showed up in my discussion section. So, I'm rambling along here, and I don't know how much this answers.
Let me interject. I should have said at the outset that the interview is being conducted by Crawford Young and Matthew Dahl at the Hart Residence. Once you had settled on the notion that you wanted to build upon the TBA experience and pursue an academic line of training that connected with that, then that led you naturally, without considering a wide range of institutional alternatives, to Madison as your first choice.
Exactly.
And what year did you start your graduate?
The summer of 46. And it was, of course, logical for me to take whatever John Goss taught as a necessary core of my graduate courses, and I got him in two classes. One was the graduate seminar in political thought, which started with Plato's Republic, of course, and it didn't get too far beyond that, but his Plato's Republic was plenty of political theory, and his very large lecture course on American political thought, which was entirely organized around Henry Adams.
Oh, the Education of Henry Adams.
Yes, the Education of Henry Adams.
So, was John Goss then your mentor or your...
Yes, he was, but he advisor? Only stayed at Wisconsin for a year.
For a year, that's right, he left in 47.
And then he accepted a position at Harvard. And I asked him whether he would support my idea that I should accompany him to Harvard. And he said, no, you're much better off here at Wisconsin. He was quite definite about that, and so I accepted his advice.
Did you know that he was planning to leave for Harvard when
he wasn't planning, I'm sure. And I want to mention before I forget it that one of the memorable aspects of my studying under him was that every Saturday afternoon in his house on Lilas Avenue, he held open house on his sun porch, and I attended three or four of those sessions. He demonstrated to me a kind of, I have to say, urbanity mm-hmm. in dealing with a very miscellaneous string of drop-in graduate students of the most diverse backgrounds. English majors, history majors, people who, like me, had been some years out of their undergraduate work, had been in affairs, people who were from some short Washington government experience, and he invariably had an interest in what they had been up to and a series of questions that drew them out. And I never was able to achieve that sort of urbanity and general hospitality to everybody's separate interests, but it certainly created a model for me.
We came across some evidence that John Goss had actually been contacted by Harvard earlier and had turned them down.
I see.
But that apparently his frustration and disappointment over the McMurray issue had something to do with
that. So I had no
with
idea.
His decision to leave.
I had no idea, Crawford. Let me just put in. He was available to us when I was chair of the the Graduate Student Club. There was some sort of institution. We brought him back we had him address us with the assignment to compare the students, grad and undergrad, at Harvard with those at Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And he made two remarks. One is, people at that age are all growing so fast intellectually and upon their own directions of thought that it doesn't matter too much where they are studying. If they get a good breakfast every morning and you keep stirring them up, they will work towards their potential. He said, I cannot make any generic comparison between these two batches of students, except I think the Wisconsin ones I dealt with were more teachable.
Did you any contact with Goss before you came here? I mean, how did you?
No, I had no contact. I just read some of his things, especially this work that he was in charge of, the title of which was Regional Factors in National Planning and Development. And that was a publication of one of the New Deal agencies. I've forgotten what the agency was called, but it was the study on regional planning in the United States and its potential. And in those yeasty times, it raised the question, can all of the field operations of government be organized around a set of fairly multi-purpose regions?
So when you began your graduate study, it was your intention to prepare yourself as a specialist in regional planning,
yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
And American government
yes.
More broadly. Well, once you found that you were going to lose your mentor, who then replaced John Goss as your primary advisor?
Let me add something about Goss before I finish with him. When I was looking for essentially a doctor's research subject, but incidentally, I was going to start out at the master's level with a master's thesis on that same subject, so I could really develop it. I proposed, I suppose, rather logically, that I make some kind of appraisal of the TVA. And Gauss's response was, no, you cannot do that. I was absolutely thrown back, not on my heels, on my back, because that seemed to cancel my reasons.
Yeah.
I was not, at that time, satisfied of his, whatever his reasoning was. He didn't give me any very thorough reason. He just said no. But looking back, I can understand it was absolutely essential element of my intellectual growth, because it was possible for him to see that my idea of TVA, although I'd come to study it from an academic perspective, was still contained within the company line of David E. Lilienthal, from his little book, which, you know, captured the attention of the world, which explained the rationale of the TVA, that you could do all of government better if you had these decentralized agencies that were headed by autonomous boards that were carefully chosen and given great freedom to make decisions at the grassroots level. And the key, I won't say error, but gross exaggeration in that Lilienthal view was that the fact that the agency had a lot of power devolved upon it, and that it was headquartered in the region where its administration was taking place, that made it responsive, per se, to the political voices, the political interests of the people in the region. And of course, that was not the basis on which TVA was responsive to the people in the Tennessee Valley. It was because the TVA's support was so balanced between its friends and its foes that the congressman from the Valley, the fractions of that, of seven states that the Valley encompassed, those congressmen had life or death power over it as far as annual appropriations are concerned, and much else beside. And I didn't have the slightest inkling of that. I just accepted the Lilienthal line. And it must have been evident to a fellow who had really worked on the question of devolution of powers through this sort of institution.
How many years were you at TVA, all in all?
I was 36 through 43, so I was 6 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very formative period for me. This must be in the other interview.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I learned, I would say, you know, if you want to be roughly quantitative, I would say about half of my intellectual development was in that experience in Vanderbilt.
Well, at that time, polemics surrounding TVA, am I correct, largely revolved around allegations of its enemies, that it was a socialistic kind of undertaking and so forth. And some of the kinds of criticisms that have come up in much more recent times by environmentalists and some others were, I presume, things that never were mentioned.
It was entirely on the environmental development side. Nobody questioned reservoirs as benign environmental changes made by man. And there was, of course, some fascinating internal fighting between Lilienthal and Arthur Morgan. But that was not mainly a popular issue. Popular issues concerning it were essentially this socialism question, and some people were concerned still about the constitutionality question, whether the accounts were honest, which allocated expenses to power production as against the non-reimbursable navigation and flood control. That was a very big controversy issue.
So, in the end, what was your MA thesis when you were forbidden from doing EBA?
When I got up off the floor, I decided I've got to take some other river basin.
Started on Missouri Valley.
Yeah, and I decided, I've got to say that this is strange now, but there was a very lively congressional argument over whether this huge project that was looked at as one of the post-war development projects that had to be done because of the terrible flooding that was taking place on the Missouri River, and because of the obvious interaction and also conflict between the uses of the river sources for irrigation as against navigation. And navigation is such a water user, and irrigation requires water consumption that in that basin was a threat because it was a huge basin with an enormous amount of land that could potentially be irrigated. But if you take it out for irrigation, you haven't got it to float the barges on the, on the channel below Omaha. And so that fight resulted in both the Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers producing their own master plans for the whole basin.
Mm-hmm.
And the absurdity of the separate approach became evident when the congressional committees looked at the plans and found that one of the reservoirs that was being earmarked for irrigation in the eastern portion of the basin above Omaha would have been flooded out by the Army's great storage basin for the barge channel, and yet both agencies submitted these absolutely contradictory plans to the Congress for authorization. And so
so that was fascinating enough as an MA thesis, so that it later became your doctoral research as well. Before getting to that, let's pick up on other aspects of your graduate experience. Who replaced John Goss as your advisor?
Jim McCaney.
And
Crawford, excuse me. I've got to say, I'll get to this, I guess, in answer to some of the later questions, but the aura, at least, of Frederick Austin Ogg was very powerful during the first few years I was there, and I attended his great retirement celebration.
That was in 47?
That must have been.
Yeah.
Must have been 47, maybe 48. But it was especially powerful for me because we were in South Hall then. There wasn't any room for me. And so I was put at a desk in a corner of his anteroom, which was his room for receiving books for review in the American Political Science Review. And his routine was to keep piling up the books that he did not send out for review, which must have been 9 out of 10, on, I would think, a 4x6 table in the middle of that room, until the pyramid got so high that they slipped off onto the floor. And then he would post a note outside.
Free books.
Come select one book from these books that have been sent in for review, and check off your name when all of the assistant professors have made their selection. Then the associate professors may come in, and then the full professor. Oh, that was such an interesting procedure.
How would you characterize this aura of Og? What, how did it manifest itself? Was it just his towering prestige, or was it anything specific about his intellectual contribution?
It was certainly that, but of course, his textbook was the imperative textbook for the American government course. He gave us a sense that we were pretty much at the headquarters of American political science of the United States, and I think it tended to give us young fellows a good deal of confidence that if we could make it here, we would be in the mainstream of political science.
Mm-hmm. Beyond Og and Goss, was there anybody else at the time that you were a graduate student that really stood out in the department? That was a time of great turnover.
Yeah, well, Bill Ebenstein was an outstanding man. He was such a distinctive, I've got to say, self-confident personality that he made his mark. And he had a lot of unconventional, to me, ideas that he put forward quite outside of any.
Did you have courses with Ebenstein?
I had a course with Ebenstein. I remember that he, one of the things that he told us, I don't know whether it was apropos of politics in Latin America or apropos of politics of race, but he said, Brazil is a country which demonstrates that race need not be a divisive aspect in a polity, that if you didn't have this strange English-American notion that that the races have to be separated as to marriage, that you wouldn't have any trouble at all in mixing people's ethnicity so that it became a fairly harmless human difference.
Had Ebenstein, he was a refugee from the 30s,
I think,
epic.
So. I think so.
I don't know whether he had already finished his graduate training when he fled Germany or Austria, wherever he came from.
I don't know that either.
But he was, by the time you came as a graduate student, he already had a significant reputation in the field. I guess he left for Princeton, didn't he?
Yes.
Again, shortly after you started your graduate career. Was McCamey, when he became your advisor, already a visible person in the field?
I thought of him mostly as a man who had made his mark in Washington during the war, and he had a fairly important job. I don't know if it was in the War Production Board or what, but he was deep into some important bureaucratic functions of running the war.
Mm-hmm. And then he was involved in the occupation of authority, I think, of Germany or Austria.
Maybe so. I don't remember that.
I'm not sure of that.
Bill also had a big impact on me because uh, Wait a minute, if I may go back, there was a third graduate seminar that I took with Goss, and that was a regional planning seminar. And that was one where he, maybe 15 of us who took that were about as interdisciplinary as you could ever expect in a graduate seminar. And he, to illustrate that, he brought in the Madison superintendent of education then, because that man, according to Goss, had demonstrated remarkable initiative in predicting where the Madison population was going to spread in the next 15 years, and buying up elementary and high school sites in those locations while the land was still readily available at the ideal spot, because he saw that schools were a very important community building regional planning. That's the kind of thing that I think Goss was uniquely good at.
Mm-hmm. What was your, as a student, did you find that that you were different than him intellectually, that you disagreed with any of his views, or did you find that he was very convincing, particularly as a lecturer? Was he very convincing in the classroom? Did you find that you just you know what I'm asking there? His
yes.
Analytical approach.
I've got to say that I was not at that point confident enough of my knowledge of political science. I had been so flimsily prepared at the time, I think, to have much of a stance to criticize him.
Mm-hmm.
I know now that some of his ideas were very partial coverage of the subject matter that he purported to cover in his classes, and the best illustration of that comes out of the comparison of two great Wisconsin minds, John Goss and Merle Curtin, because his education of Henry Adams was about 180 degrees different from Merle Curtin's view of the history of American political thought. I mean, if you could ever get two modern scholars, 20th century scholars, who more faithfully represented the intellectual position of the Hamiltonians and the early 20th century reformers who were based on, you know, on administration, that was Goss, as against Curtin, who was the great exponent of the Jeffersonian, Jacksonian. The people will judge best, and no concern about how you run things or how you make a place for corporate activities and so forth. So now I know, because I had a wonderful chance to really get close to Merle Curtin during the years when he was in bad health, and Virginia and I were constant visitors to his place of residence. It was a rare privilege for me, but that way of second guessing John Goss was a later, much later part of my education, but I had no input of that at the time.
So how about Llewellyn von Kooten? Did you work with him?
I didn't have any real political science association with him. He was a marvelous friend, and I respected him, but I regarded his face in international law as absolutely outside my ken, so I I didn't have much occasion to talk to him about substantive matters.
But in your interaction with your fellow graduate students, was it a general perception that Llewellyn was a major intellectual leader in the department at the time?
I didn't have any evidence either way on that.
Was there anybody else that you particularly remember in your graduate student days?
Well, I had constitutional law with Dave Feldman, and that was a fairly conventional way of dealing with public law. We read cases and we discussed cases.
Bill Young, did he?
Yes.
Did you work with him?
Yes. Bill Young took over Goss's courses, and there couldn't be any greater contrast in personality.
Oh, yeah.
This urbane fellow and this coal miner from Pennsylvania, and you know, went and I sat in on his political theory because I had the notion that, I mean, his grad seminar in political theory had a notion that it might be different. It was different, and you know, the routine manner in which those seminars were conducted,
yeah,
especially because they were both based on Plato's Republic, it couldn't be a greater contrast. But I found out that Bill Young pried just as many ideas out of the students as Goss did, stimulated by that single text of Plato's Republic.
Let's talk a little bit more about your thesis. Who do you recollect who was on your committee, or who did you work with most closely on the dissertation?
Well, it was certainly mainly McCain.
It was somewhat outside his major field.
Yeah, that's right. And I really, I don't remember who did that. I suspect there were some people from outside the department, maybe, maybe geography, and maybe history, because...
Was Fred Clarenbach in the department at the time?
Yeah, Fred Clarenbach was there, and he certainly had to be on it. But nobody else stands out in my memory.
So you were working a good part on your own.
Yeah, I was.
I
want to put in that when I did the MA version of it, my main preparation was first to answer the question, since these great dams were being built by the Army Corps of Engineers on the main river and by the Bureau in the upcountry, and they were built by contract. The TVA had prided itself on building its dams by force account, and the TVA rationale was, if we do this, we will avoid the corruption that frequently accompanies the letting of contracts, and B, we will have many, many byproducts that you can capture if you hire your own people. And I wanted to see how the Army Corps, which had the biggest contracts, were letting these contracts, and whether there were any corrupt features of that. That was fundamental question before I got to the more subtle points. And so I decided the best way to find that out is to get a job on one of the dam construction projects.
Oh.
So I purchased a 1939 Chevrolet. I decided to spend the summer first working for 6 weeks on one of these dams and then touring around the circumference of the basin. And the dam I worked on was called Fort Andes Dam. It's the lowest dam on the main Missouri River in the southeastern corner of South Dakota. So it was hard then to get carpenter tools, but I had been raised with some experience in carpentry work by my father on our summer place.
Oh, so your carpentry interest has very distant roots.
Well, it's different from woodworking, but yep. At least it involved using saws and hammers mm-hmm. and nails and all that stuff. So I made up a plywood toolbox. I finally found in that time a shortage right after the war. I found a pretty good saw and other carpenter tools. And I put them in the plywood toolbox and got in the Chevrolet and drove out to the dam site at Lake Andy, South Dakota. And I arrived there on a Saturday morning, and as I expected, the thing was going full blast. They were trying to build that dam. And so I said, "Where's the carpenter foreman?" And they said, "Over there, 100 yards over there." And I went over there, and I said, "I'm a carpenter. I want a job on the dam." They were then at the early stage of building temporary barracks. They had some World War II surplus stuff, and they were putting up barracks for the construction workers to live in. And the carpenter foreman said, "You have your tools?" I said, "Yeah." "You have your union card?" I said, "No." "Nope." "Well, tomorrow's Sunday, but you drive to Mitchell, South Dakota, and they're open on Sunday, and you get your union card, and you come back here Monday morning at 6:30. So that was my selection process. And I went to work on that dam, and it was just fascinating work, and I quickly established that it was not, the contract had not been let correctly. It was a contract by one of the big national construction companies based on the West Coast, but the only possible concept of corruption that you could say was evidence was the fact that the firm that got the contract for this building, the temporary camp, was obviously in a good position to make a low bid for the big job because they knew the lay of the land, they had a contract with the labor supply, and they could make a much more carefully measured bid, but that's not corruption. that's just a form of asset that the Army was buying. So I settled that, and it gave me enough money. I worked 70 hours a week, and I made more dollars during the 6 weeks I worked there than I ever made until I got to be an associate professor. So I had enough money to finance this trip around the rest of the basin, and it was an eye-opening notion, and it completely got me out of the Tennessee Valley context, because that basin is so utterly different. It's different, hydraulically. It's just a many-fold bigger area of land with no bigger water supply in it. Mm-hmm. And the contrast in almost every measure between the humid lower part of the river and the high Rockies part of the watershed, and then the dry northern plains in between. This is just a completely different setting, and I just thoroughly, utterly abandoned the idea that the River Basin Authority located here could function successfully on anything like the TVA model.
Uh-huh. So, well, apparently it must have been a very good thesis, because it provided the basis for the invitation to you to stay on as an instructor.
I don't.
And you got it published subsequently as a book.
I don't fully understand that decision, to tell you the truth. I don't know why the department made that move, but I certainly thank God it did. My most serious effort to get a job before the department offered me was at the University of Wyoming, and I prepared my case as strongly as I possibly could, and the chair at Wyoming was a fellow who had some Wisconsin contacts, so that I think he was favorable to me, but I didn't make it, and I don't know mm-hmm. what it was, but I think it's quite likely that this communist episode in my life entered in and provided extra stumbling block at a state university like Wyoming.
Huh. Yes, we want to get back to that episode in a little while. You had the Wyoming interview. Were there any other job opportunities that you considered?
No, I never got that far with any other place until this wonderful offer came.
So you began in 1951, was it? We've got this.
Maybe either 50 or 51.
Uh-huh. And so the invitation to stay on came as a surprise.
It sure did, absolutely.
I suppose that
my 6-7 years in TVA somewhat moderated the question of whether it's smart to hire a guy whose whole intellectual development has been here. We ought to bring in some varied backgrounds into our department. I think that must be the basis for the general premise that you don't hire your own PhDs.
There were some others. Well, Bill Young, of course, he had been elsewhere for a time. Charlie Anderson, a little later, was kept on. But was Jim McCamey chair when you were hired?
Quite possibly, but I don't know.
Yeah. I think Llewellyn was chair immediately after Ogg.
Okay. Yeah, he was. He was chair.
I think McCamey replaced him, and then Bill Young, I know, began in 1952.
Okay.
So you would have been already on the staff.
Yeah, I think it was McCamey. I know Llewellyn replaced Ogg.
So during your years as a young faculty member in the 1950s, who were the most influential members of the department at the time? Could one speak of two or three people that were really especially dominant in department affairs?
Well, I don't think of anybody except Bill Young and Kamey. We had a fellow who was from Canada, who was something of a Marxist. He was a
see the Latin American person?
Maybe, but I cannot recall his name. He was not a dominant person.
Is that Bill Stokes?
No, Bill Stokes was a fellow that I TA'd for quite early. And I don't think he was completely integrated in the life and thought of the department. Partly, he had this weekly radio program in Chicago he used to drive down to. And the perception of us graduate students was that he was a little bit peripheral. But I cannot say what his influence was, but of course he didn't stay on.
Something I've been curious about, going back to Fred Clarenbach and also Coleman Woodbury, who was hired, I think, a little later.
And
then both of them went over to urban and regional planning when that department was created. But there was, in the last volume of the history of Wisconsin, the university that Cronin and Jenkins did, there's a long section on the idea encouraged by the Ford Foundation of the university becoming a major center of urban studies, with the notion that that was more than an academic kind of study. It was a kind of engagement in what was then perceived to be the crisis of the great cities and so forth, and that Clarenbach and Woodbury were to be part of that.
I had a course with Woodbury, and I've got to say I learned a great deal.
Really?
A valuable course, because it was, he was au courant with the government, with the Washington policy moves to, for example, create a public housing program. He also, I think, himself was quite important in the process of urban redevelopment, which.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like dam building, and now has a dark side. Of course,
a lot
of the projects that he taught us about have been dynamited. But I want to say that this is getting way ahead of the story chronologically. But my perception was that very much giant forward moves that the university made in the field of these area studies, which I was a part, those were championed by Fred Harvey Harrington.
Yeah.
And as you know from this other interview that I gave, I think, I got very close to him. And I remember that Harrington came over with his wife and talked to Virginia and me.
I remember that.
Remember that
tape,
story?
Yeah.
And I just guess, I have no way of confirming this, but I guess that Harrington maybe looked at Coleman Woodbury as he looked at me as a vehicle for
a vision he had.
Yeah, for moving ahead on this track while he was vice president, that might demonstrate that with the support that can be garnered from Washington and from foundations, that the university administrator like him, who would really jump on this potential and push it for all it's worth, could expand the university's capabilities without relying on state general revenue at all. And so it became a sort of positive sum gain.
Right.
And I think that he got, I don't know whether it was a development of UW-Milwaukee or whether it was the lack of dynamism by Woodbury, but I think he dropped off some on the urban development side of it and put more of his eggs into this area studies.
Which did take root and take off.
It sure did.
It may be that this domestic tandem to the Harrington vision on the urban side was not realistic in the way that he had conceptualized it. That it didn't have wouldn't have been an easy way for some huge action-oriented kind of center of urban rejuvenation.
It wasn't as novel and dramatic and visible, perhaps.
Yeah,
as more difficult, more complicated to actually create.
And I suppose you, in contrast to area studies, you instantly run up against the kind of political and administrative establishments of the cities and so forth, which didn't really have a counterpart in area studies.
And the United States government, of course, got completely captivated with the language and area studies because of the Soviet competition angle, and that was not fueling the urban studies.
Woodbury and Kleinbach were in the 50s, while they were in the department, were not really central figures in the leadership of the department.
No, they weren't.
Another enigmatic figure, Jack Salter.
Oh yeah.
Well, no, was he?
Sure, he was always there, and he was always sort of out of sight. And the grad students had the perception that he'd published this one quite significant book on
lost politics. Yeah.
Yeah, in Chicago. And that was it, and that he had not contributed anymore. And he was personally eccentric. And so I think he was sort of relegated to the margins.
Yeah. So, and that was already the case in
yes.
when you were a graduate student. Okay. There you go. Do you recollect any debates within the department on the larger direction the department should take? In the 50s, what became known as the behavioral revolution was just beginning to take shape. And was there any point at which there was some kind of conscious reflection that you recall as to whether the department needed to reshape or rethink itself in function of that?
My notion is that that was a long-running competition between visions of political science, and it I don't think it galvanized any specific conflict in the department. Mm-hmm. It certainly preoccupied me, and I don't know if this is the point in our memories to bring it in, but I accepted that the future of political science was going to be rigorous hypothesis testing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that was an idea coming new to me after I had finished all of my training.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to retrain myself
mm-hmm.
In some specific ways that we can get to. But I did pattern my research increasingly upon that model of rigorous hypothesis testing. But I never was so adept at that that I could really get the full benefit of what I attempted. And so I was constantly, right to the end, I was constantly having to decide between what I felt really good at and what I thought I ought to be doing.
Well, was there anybody within the department that was nudging you in that direction in your early years?
No, just in a vague, reading the American Political Science Review, seeing what they were publishing,
uh-huh.
and constant small discussions about candidates coming in and what qualities we were looking for,
mm-hmm.
and those segmental considerations, they
mm-hmm.
they reflected that change quite well, but it wasn't any concentrated debate as to which way we ought to go.
So you said they're sort of competing visions for the discipline.
During the time that I was there,
mm-hmm.
Right up to 1982 when I retired from university, the rigorous political science view, rigorous social science view of hypothesis testing, being a